really would be very disheartening to see them choose other locations over Alaska.
Lawmakers consider putting more money into the Film Tax Incentive Program. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new breed of medical provider that could transform the health system.
Really, at the core, everybody wants to be healthy. They really do. We just have not been able to help them achieve those goals with our traditional approach.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
A special State House Finance Subcommittee opened hearings today on a bill to continue to expand a program offering tax incentives for production companies making movies in Alaska. Anchorage Democrat Johnny Ellis sponsored the bill that passed the Senate with no opposition. He said the state subsidizes other industries and told the subcommittee that the goal is to diversify the state's economy.
This was not my idea. It came from the private sector businesses here in Alaska, large and small, who see an opportunity to do, not to recreate Hollywood in Alaska, but to have a small, incremental, sustainable effort in this exciting new industry.
Currently, movie and television producers can get up to 44% of their production costs as transferable tax credits. The current law also allows the state to issue $100 million in credits every year. The Alaska Film Office says it has qualified 77 productions and set aside $67 million in credits. SB 23 would increase industry participation by allowing $200 million in credits. Juanetta Ayers, the state's Director of Economic Development, says 41 of the productions on the books right now are for nonfiction television programs, 21 are for feature films, with the rest described primarily as commercials, documentaries, or fictional TV. She said one of the goals is to have productions that focus on Alaska actually made in Alaska.
There are a number of Alaska-centric productions that have looked at Alaska, but we need to actively pursue those to make sure that we win some of the productions that have such specific content, such specific stories to Alaska, that it really would be very disheartening to see them choose other locations over Alaska.
As an example, Ellis mentioned a film called The Cruelest Mile about the Iditarod that has scouted several locations in the state but has not agreed to shoot here. Ellis said the movie still could be shot in Romania or British Columbia. The bill will come up again next Tuesday before the subcommittee. The majority caucus in the Alaska House of Representatives has released some new polling data that seeks to gauge the importance of issues being addressed by the legislature. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The new polling data was collected by Dittman Research and Communications. The company surveyed 1,000 Alaskans earlier this month, and the majority caucus in the Alaska House issued a statement noting that the data will be used as the legislature enters the home stretch of the legislative session. 53% of those surveyed labeled the Alaska economy as quite good, 21% characterized the economy as not too good. The results of the poll were outlined Tuesday by Matt Larkin. He's the new owner of Dittman Research and Communications.
Alaskans are feeling good about things, generally. They're feeling good about the state. They're feeling good about our economy. They're feeling good about their elected leadership, both in the House, the Senate, and in the governors. They're feeling good about the opportunities that we have.
A closer look at the data from the poll shows that 44% of respondents labeled the current level of state spending as about right, while 30% says spending is too high. One of the issues that has come to the forefront so far this legislative session is the level of education funding in Alaska. The polling data indicates that 30% of Alaskans believe the level of funding is too low, 30% labeled the level of funding as about right. In regards to the high cost of energy, 65% of those who participated in the poll say the governor and the legislature are not doing enough to help Alaskans with those high energy costs. 54% of respondents noted that the state needs a much greater emphasis on funding and building major long-term energy projects like the Susitna Dam, regional power grid improvements, and an in-state gas pipeline. The idea of building a large natural gas pipeline to market the natural gas from the North Slope has been on the table for decades, and 47% of those polled say they are not too confident that the AGEA plan will be successful in getting a natural gas pipeline for Alaska. 27% say they are not at all confident. Larkin says generally confidence in AGEA is low.
This is consistent with what our finding last year when we measured the same issue. Confidence in AGEA, when it first came out, was very high, and it's fallen off precipitously the last few years.
The polling data suggests that 45% of Alaskans believe the ACE's tax plan should be modified, and 28% say it should be kept as is. ACE's is the plan that sets out oil and gas tax rates in Alaska. 49% of poll respondents say that it's extremely important for the legislature to make significant changes to the oil tax structure this year, and another 40% of respondents labeled making changes as somewhat important. 49% of poll respondents support the tax model being put forward by the state Senate, and 43% support the approach being supported by Governor Sean Parnell. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The Federal Subsistence Board for Alaska will not release its position on a Village Corporation's petition to change management of nearby state fisheries. Angoon's Kootsnawoo Incorporated filed what's called an extraterritorial jurisdiction petition last year. It said state managers have allowed commercial fishermen to take too many sockeyes, lowering the village's catch. It wants the federal government to claim jurisdiction over the Western Admiralty Island fishery and give subsistence a higher priority. The board began hearing about the issue yesterday at its meeting in Juneau, but it will not make its position public after it completes deliberations. It will only send a sealed recommendation to Agriculture Department Secretary Tom Vilsack and Interior Department Secretary Ken Salazar. Pete Probasco is Assistant Regional Director for Subsistence Management for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Secretary Salazar and Secretary Vilsack have retained the authority for where that regulation resides to themselves. And so because of that, and it hasn't been delegated to the board, all the board can do is make a recommendation that's confidential, which the secretary will consider along with whatever other information he collects from public, etc.
Probasco said the secretaries usually respond to such recommendations within 4 to 6 weeks. The subsistence board will make its decision during a closed-door executive session at the end of the public portion of its meeting Friday. Before that, it will hear from its Southeast Regional Advisory Council. Members are also participating in this week's meeting. The federal government is considering closing 3 courthouses in Alaska. According to documents obtained by the Associated Press, courthouses in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Fairbanks could be shut down as part of an effort to cut costs. If all 3 did close, the only active federal courthouse in Alaska would be in Anchorage. Senator Lisa Murkowski responded to the news in a statement saying it's penny-wise, pound-foolish to remove 3 out of our 4 active courts and ask all Alaskans to travel to Anchorage for legal proceedings. Up to 60 court sites in 29 states could be closed. The government ranked the court sites that could be shut down based on categories such as usage and location. A similar list of potential court closures is generated every 2 years. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, improving the Sitka salmon hatchery.
Last fall, we saw this flood several times where the water was about 1 to 2 feet over the top of all of these concrete walls.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
Most of us want to be healthier, but motivating to do anything about it is often difficult. Now a new kind of health professional could help. They're called health coaches. In Anchorage, Providence Hospital thinks it's a model that could help transform the healthcare system in the years ahead. And for the last few years, they've been testing the idea with employees. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Every morning, Shannon Orley parks as far away as possible from her office. And on the sprawling Providence Hospital complex, that is really far away.
Right and around 1,000 steps each way. Definitely worth it.
It's below zero on a recent morning, but thanks to the hospital's extensive sky bridge system, Shannon's walk is mostly indoors, with impressive views of the Chugach Mountains along the way.
Oh, it's beautiful. You see moose a lot of times running around. Well, not running. They kind of walk on the trails underneath of the sky bridge.
2 years ago, Shannon was obese, and she faced a dilemma. She had just taken a job helping coordinate Providence's employee wellness program, but her own wellness was far off track. She drank the equivalent of 6 sodas a day in big gulps, loved fast food, and didn't exercise much. So she decided to take advantage of one of the hospital's new benefits, health coaching. At first, the lifestyle changes she made were very small.
We started out where my goal was just to take the stairs instead of the elevator once a day. Not even more than that, but, you know, just really manageable.
Soon, Shannon was drinking more water and less soda. She began walking regularly and attending Pilates classes. She kicked her fast food habit and lost 50 pounds. Last year, 300 of Providence's 2,800 employees in Anchorage tried health coaching. Shannon's coach, Kelly Highhold, says her clients have finally made the decision to change.
When they actually make that step and make an appointment with me, they're ready. And they say, you know, help me. I know what I need to do. I just don't know how to get there.
Health coaches are still rare in the medical profession, but they're becoming more popular as chronic and often preventable diseases like type 2 diabetes consume more and more healthcare dollars. Tammy Green heads up Providence's extensive employee wellness program. She thinks coaches are an important piece of the healthcare puzzle that's been missing. She says nobody wants to be overweight.
And I think that's kind of the fallacy that we've kind of had this traditional approach that people just don't want to change, but really, at the core, everybody wants to be healthy. They really do. We just have not been able to help them achieve those goals with our traditional approach.
In 3 years of health coaching, Providence has seen a small but steady decrease in the number of obese employees, from 36% in 2009 to 32% in 2011. Green says blood pressure and cholesterol levels are lower, and fewer employees are smoking. She says it's a good start.
Something's happening, and you can pretty much assure yourself that if we had not been doing anything, we certainly wouldn't see those kind of trends.
Green likes to think big, and she makes a convincing argument that health coaches will play a major role in the healthcare system in the years ahead. Green is talking with the University of Alaska and Alaska Pacific University about starting programs to train health coaches. There aren't any national education standards yet for health coaching, but Margaret Moore, who co-directs the Institute of Coaching at McLean Hospital in Boston, is working to change that. Her institute has trained most of the country's health coaches, about 6,000 so far.
There's some ways to go for this to become mainstream, but there's a reasonable army now of health professionals that have become coaches in this last 10 years.
She expects the profession to grow steadily, especially now that Medicare has started paying for up to 20 obesity counseling sessions a year. But Moore acknowledges there's debate in the medical field over whether health coaching should be a separate profession or just a new skill set for existing providers. She thinks both are essential.
You know, just like other health professions, the more skilled the provider, the better the results. I think everybody appreciates that. And so I think that we need to create a cadre of really the best coaches and then help all health professionals be able to do at least a competent job at using these skills.
Back at Providence, Shannon Orley has reached an intersection on her walk to work. And like a former smoker trying to resist a nicotine urge, she has an important choice to make.
As you can see on the left side, we have our bank of elevators all ready to rock. On the right side, we have the stairs.
On this day, Shannon doesn't hesitate, but she says it can be a tough decision.
You know, every time I go to reach for the elevator button, there's a little voice in the back of my head, Kelly, asking me, you know, really, is this going to make you feel better? Is this part of your goal? Is this where you're headed?
And with her coach's help, healthy choices have started to feel better and better. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
An Air Force team headed to Alaska next month will assess projected savings from moving Eielson Air Force Base's F-16 squadron to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. The Site Activation Task Force team is scheduled to be at Eielson April 11th through the 14th and at Jaber the 16th through the 18th. Pacific Air Force Public Affairs Director Colonel Maria Carl in Hawaii says the team will look at all aspects of moving the F-16 squadron.
And that includes things like personnel, manpower, operations, logistics, communications, facilities kinds of things, even just personnel support services like finance, medical, that kind of thing.
Colonel Carl says the 12 to 20 member team will include representatives from Pacific Command in Hawaii, as well as the Alaska bases. Earlier this month, the Pentagon said the proposed F-16 move would reduce the number of jobs at Eielson by 668. Carl says truthing that out on the ground is one of the things the assessment team will do.
These are still proposed changes in numbers, and so this next step here with the team is to really kind of get into the nuts and bolts of what it actually would mean, not only in terms of making the move, but also the impacts.
Carl says the team will take what it learns and produce a report on the Eielson proposal in about a month's time. That makes for a tight schedule as Congress begins marking up the federal budget. Alaska Senator Mark Begich questions Secretary of the Air Force Michael Donnelly and Chief of Staff General Norton Schwartz about the timing during a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing this week.
And if you're now just going through this process of really fully doing on-the-ground analysis, how are we to make a decision when markup is occurring in short order here?
Begich, who serves on the Armed Services Committee, said he understands savings have to be achieved, but added proposals need to be based on solid information.
The problem is you're now starting to do the full analysis to understand what the savings are. I understand you did tabletop, but you know, what goes on in the Pentagon and what's real are sometimes very different.
Secretary Donnelly responded that the Air Force already has a pretty good accounting of operations at Eielson and what savings the F-16 move would realize.
We have programmed and budgeted for operations at Eielson as we do for other bases and units, and we understand generally the costs of operations at for the infrastructure, for the personnel, for the aircraft, and that is programmed. And so if we make force structure adjustments that move or reduce, we have a pretty good handle on what the personnel, flying hour, force structure, operational impacts are, and those numbers are used as the basis for our decision.
Donnelly did not provide a specific number when Senator Begich asked for civilian job impacts.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska.
A weekend rescue in the White Mountains National Recreation Area could have been avoided with some basic preparation and planning. Local musher Peg Billingsley and an out-of-state client were picked up by Alaska wildlife troopers Sunday after miscommunications and dog trouble left them stranded at two separate locations. Both women are okay, but BLM spokesman Craig McKay says the incident points out how easy it is for things to go wrong in the wilderness, even along marked and groomed trails in the White Mountains.
You need to be prepared, whether that's your equipment and gear, whether it's your physical fitness, fitness of your dogs, if you're using dogs. You need to have emergency backup plans and ways of communicating, and you need to not bite off more than you can chew, I guess.
McKay says the other thing the incident has brought up is the issue of guiding on federal land. Billingsley was guiding without a permit from the BLM. McKay says the permit system provides protections for everyone involved.
The process requires reviewing safety measures, conflicts with other things that might be going on out in public lands, possible environmental impacts and ways to avoid those. And some kinds of activities require insurance. In the end, this all protects the clients, the guides or commercial operators, our staff, search and rescue people, and the general public.
McKay says there can be repercussions for violating the guiding rules, and the BLM is investigating the Billingsley case. McKay says it's fortunate that no one suffered any serious injury in the incident. Alaska's redistricting board will be hearing from Petersburg again as it puts together a new plan for the state's legislative boundaries. The Petersburg City Council voted this week to resubmit a proposal that it remain in a district with Sitka instead of being bundled with the much larger city of Juneau. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Petersburg City Manager Steve Giesbrecht spoke with the city's former redistricting attorney last week, shortly after news broke that the Alaska Supreme Court had ordered a new redistricting plan. Giesbrecht told the city council about that conversation Monday night.
He at this point is not suggesting that we get him back involved. It's not time for that. But he did suggest that if the council was interested, that a letter going back and stating our original case might be appropriate to get it in the hands of the redistricting board.
The Alaska Redistricting Board has started meeting to work on a new plan in compliance with the court order. The justices essentially found that in an effort to first satisfy the Federal Voting Rights Act, the board failed to meet requirements under the state constitution. The court told the board to produce a new plan that first complies with state law and only then, quote, make revisions that deviate from the Alaska Constitution when deviation is the only means available to satisfy Voting Rights Act requirements, unquote. Petersburg's mayor and councilors agreed the ruling provided the town with a second chance to pursue their concerns and asked the board to reconsider the town's request from last summer that it remain in a legislative district with Sitka. Councilor Mark Jensen.
I think it'd be a good idea for the city staff to resubmit that along with some information to the redistricting board, you know, reiterating what the Supreme Court said about following the state constitution and putting that before the Voters' Rights Act.
Petersburg has long shared a Senate district with Sitka, Wrangell, Ketchikan, and some smaller towns. That district's currently represented by Republican Bert Stedman, co-chair of the powerful Senate Finance Committee. The redistricting board's current plan shifts Petersburg to a district that includes Juneau and Skagway. Petersburg challenged the plan in court but lost and chose not to appeal. The Supreme Court ruling is the result of another legal challenge from two Fairbanks residents. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
The hatchery program at the Sitka Sound Science Center is getting a helping hand from the Pacific Salmon Commission. The center has been awarded $130,000 in grant funding to improve the hatchery's water intake system, which was originally built around the turn of the 20th century to float logs to the sawmill at the Sheldon Jackson Training School. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Yeah, you can see over here all the junk, because the river is... The river's actually going down now. It was up quite a bit.
The wooden flume is long since gone, replaced 30 years ago by a 48-inch pipe, but the Indian River still looks untamed here on the north side of Sawmill Creek Highway. Strictly speaking, a river this centrally located in Sitka might be called an urban waterway, but nature did not get the memo.
And even this river will shift around a lot. You'll get a big flood, and that gravel bar on the inside of this bow can move around. And if the river kind of cuts through the trees here on the upstream side, all of a sudden a lot of water can come over here and flows can be completely changed. So one thing about rivers is they're alive. They move all over the place.
When it was a college program, this hatchery trained many people who continue to work in aquaculture around the state. You'd think the setup would be near perfect. In fact, Garrison says it's far from ideal. The problem is this wild river.
And a river is not generally a great water source for a hatchery because a couple of things. It has a lot of debris in it. It's carrying bed load all the time. Certainly in August and September, October, November, it's got fish in it. A lot of salmon, and we end up with a lot of salmon carcasses, and then we end up with really high loads of bacteria in the water, and it makes it very difficult for us at the hatchery.
Difficult is putting it nicely. The hatchery's water supply was cut off four times last fall when the intake clogged. Backup pumps saved the incubating eggs, but Garrison says there were many sleepless nights. The hatchery rears 3 million pink salmon and 1 million coho eggs. It currently has 20,000 coho smolt nearing release, along with 100,000 chinook. Garrison says they're phasing out Chinook to concentrate on Coho, which costs less to rear and return sooner. Despite the temperamental nature of rivers, Garrison says they're used by hatcheries all over the world. He thinks the Science Center's problems can be solved by a modern device installed in this historic intake.
They call it a rotating, self-cleaning mechanical screen. So it's got it's kind of like a porous conveyor belt, and it just keeps rotating, and it's got a spray bar on one side, and it washes it off, and the debris goes back off into the river.
And it's water-powered?
No, it'd be electrically powered. So it would have to, you know, that's one of the drawbacks, is it would be electrically driven. But as I look at this system right here at the river, last fall we saw this flood several times where the water was about 1 to 2 feet over the top of all of these concrete walls.
Wow.
So all of a sudden you go, well, now how do we plan for that? Mm-hmm. You know, because it's a massive amount of water. I mean, this thing can just be roaring.
He's surprised that no adventurous youth or unlucky cat has taken a ride down the penstock pipe. The main thing, though, and the reason the Pacific Salmon Commission is involved, is saving fish. The hazards of losing this water supply are all too real.
It happened 2 years ago. The water quit. All of the fish that they had in the tanks and the incubators died, and so you had nothing to release the next year. Huge loss.
The amount of that loss is hard to pin down. It depends on ocean survival rates and the price of fish. The commercial fleet catches about half of Sitka's hatchery returns. Sport anglers intercept many as well. Does the potential loss exceed the $130,000 cash investment plus matching funds from the Science Center? Oh yes, says Garrison. Absolutely. Reporting from the Indian River in Sitka, Alaska, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Dillingham, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Join business, civic, and government leaders from across Alaska and the nation at the 2012 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, April 19th and 20th at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Clean energy is a $250 billion a year business worldwide, and Alaska has the potential to be a world leader in this growing field. Information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.